From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, Mixed Signals, we hear from South Africa as the man at the centre of the fake sign language fiasco at Nelson Mandela's memorial finally speaks out.
We know that this individual had a number of incidents during his tenure as an interpreter at the court. There's documentary evidence articulating and documenting a number of alleged incidents of violence.
Also today we have the very latest on the House vote on the US budget deal, and we learn why a ruling by India's Supreme Court has outraged the country's homosexual community.
I mean, I think there's definitely a lot of marginalization of the gay community and the transgender community. Constitutional and a legal standpoint, we need to protect them much more than what we do right now.
That's coming up on FSN Reports, after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Nina Maria Potts. North Korea's state news agency has reported that the uncle of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has been executed after being purged for corruption. Chang Song-taek was pulled out of a party meeting by armed guards earlier this week, as Lorna Shaddock reports.
Chang Song-taek was once one of North Korea's most influential figures, widely acknowledged to be the real power behind Kim Jong-un. But earlier this week, he was accused of forming factions against the state, as well as of corruption and committing depraved acts, including womanizing and drug abuse. The North Korean news agency KCNA, after announcing his execution, called him despicable human scum, worse than a dog, and accused Chang Song-taek of perpetrating cursed acts of treachery. His surprising and dramatic removal, filmed at a party meeting this week, marks the biggest upheaval of power in North Korea since Mr. Kim succeeded his father 2 years ago. Analysts fear that it signals a generational change, as the young Kim tries to consolidate his power and change his advisers to give himself a stronger political base. Lorna Shaddock, Washington.
The White House says President Obama expressed no concerns about his security in South Africa. A spokesman was reacting to reports from South Africa that a sign language interpreter at Nelson Mandela's memorial service has a history of mental illness and violence. From Washington, Simon Marks reports.
For the White House, the question about this week's events in South Africa are mounting. How could President Obama have stood so close to a sign language interpreter now facing questions about his qualifications and his struggle with mental illness? A White House spokesman said he couldn't comment on specific security preparations made ahead of Tuesday's memorial, but he tried to assure reporters that the Secret Service goes to great efforts to protect the president. However, he was surrounded by a crowd that had not been security screened and flanked by an interpreter with violent incidents in his past. The questions for South African authorities are growing. Simon Marks, Washington.
Bangladesh has executed a top Islamist leader, Abdul Qadar Mullah, in the country's first conviction under its International Crimes Tribunal. The tribunal was set up in 2010 to investigate atrocities committed during the 1971 War of Independence with Pakistan. Mullah was a senior figure in the Jamaat-e-Islami party. His trial sparked protests earlier this year. His execution appeared to have been rushed through following a heated legal debate over his conviction. Political analysts have warned his execution could trigger more protests, further dividing the country. But others have applauded the decision, calling it historic. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Ukraine's President Viktor Yanukovych still intends to sign a deal on closer EU ties, according to the bloc's foreign policy chief. Catherine Ashton has been speaking in Brussels after meeting pro-EU protesters who have brought the centre of the Ukrainian capital, Kiev, to a standstill. Demonstrators have been on the streets of Kiev since President Yanukovych backed away from an EU association agreement after pressure from Moscow. But Baroness Ashton says he has given her the impression he will eventually sign it.
Look, Yanukovych made it clear to me that he intends to sign the association agreement. What he talked about were the short-term economic issues that the country faces. And it is my view that those challenges, which are real, can be addressed by the support that not only comes from the European Union institutions, but actually by showing that he has a serious economic plan in signing the association agreement, also will help to bring in kind of investment that he needs.
Australia's High Court has struck down the Australian Capital Territory's same-sex marriage laws. Arthur Stevens reports.
The ACT enacted its same-sex marriage legislation in November, with the first couples marrying last weekend. In that time, about 30 couples have tied the knot. In its decision on Thursday, the High Court held that only Australia's federal parliament had the power under the Australian Constitution to legislate for same-sex marriage. Supporters of gay marriage are dismayed at the ruling, with Australian Marriage Equality National Director Rodney Croom saying the ruling is devastating for couples who married this week. Western Australian State Upper House Parliamentarian Stephen Dawson, who married his partner in Canberra last Saturday, called the court decision disappointing. Meanwhile, the Australian Christian Lobby has applauded the High Court ruling. I'm Arthur Stevens, Melbourne.
And that's the latest feature story news. Nina Maria Potts reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. The man at the centre of the fake sign language interpretation at Nelson Mandela's memorial service has spoken out. Tamsankar Jantji has spoken to the world's media and has claimed his heavily criticised interpretation was due to mental illness, specifically schizophrenia. Karen Morn, a journalist with E-News Channel Africa in Johannesburg, had the chance to speak with him earlier.
Has given a number of different responses to various publications. I know that in newspapers in Johannesburg, he simply said that, he apologized for what happened. He said that he'd been overcome. When I spoke to him, he said he'd had a moment of sort of schizophrenic outburst, that he'd been overcome by happiness, and that he had temporarily lost the ability to sign. Subsequently in the interview, however, he said that he in fact had done a definitively good job and that anyone who wanted to criticize him should tell the world who should have replaced him. So he's been extremely erratic. And I have to say that in my dealings with him, and I was at his home for over an hour this morning, it's become very apparent that this is a person with quite a profound psychiatric disorder. His wife, at one stage, I asked if I could see his medication. She brought out a large plastic bag filled with quite high dosage psychiatric medications, including Epilim, which he apparently takes four or five pills a day. And it became very obvious that his responses would deviate according to where he was emotionally. So we have seen him apologize. We've also seen him being very defensive. So we've seen him attack his accusers. And in an interview with me, he actually stated that he felt that, at one point during the Mandela proceedings, his life was in danger because, quote, there was such tight security there. And he said, I could feel myself becoming sick, and I'm actually quite proud of myself that no mistake was made. Now, given that he has admitted that he suffered from violent outbursts as a result of his illness, we can read into that comment whatever we may.
His claims of suffering from violent outbursts, as you just put it, does this set off alarm bells for South African authorities who allowed this man within such close proximity to world leaders?
We know that this individual had a number of incidents during his tenure as an interpreter at the court. We know that there's documentary evidence from staff at the Boksburg Magistrate in Johannesburg articulating and documenting a number of alleged incidents of violence, of threats. We know, for instance, that he allegedly at one point held a fellow co-worker, a superior, hostage with a brick. Other interpreters in the court building hid themselves in their cars. The woman in question says she is not prepared to talk about it without the permission of the Justice Department, but the Justice Department is fully aware of this. We know, having spoken to senior justice personnel, that in fact the court staff has provided the Justice Department with copies of all her correspondence dating back several years ago about Mr. Jantji, which she resent them this morning as part of a wider governmental investigation. So certainly, from the people that I've spoken to, from some of the other staff interpreters at that court, they actually said that they were terrified of him. that his behavior was erratic and that they really feared that he could harm either himself or themselves. So there has been documentary evidence of this. The Department of Justice not responding on the record about that at this stage. They have responded off the record to confirm that they are aware that this individual was investigated by that department for 1.5 million rand fraud in which he was alleged to have made multiple false claims for interpretation to the department. But at this stage, they cannot say what happened to that investigation. So I think at this point, really, it's reached the stage where if government doesn't come out, do a proper investigation, explain itself, explain its processes, and explain where the gaps happened, I think any high-ranking politician would be loath to set foot in this country and participate in these kind of events for fear of the kind of people that are clearly being allowed access to them.
It's important to point out that this is an offshoot of the bigger story, which is, of course, the passing of Nelson Mandela. And people in South Africa are still mourning, are still paying their tributes. And we saw thousands queue to catch a glimpse of Nelson Mandela's body.
Well, I was up at about 4 o'clock this morning because I couldn't sleep. And people were tweeting at me from those queues, asking me where the buses would come. These are people, I mean, we must remember that the South African government has chosen not to provide public holidays for people to go and view Nelson Mandela lying in state. These are people who have taken days off, who have brought their families, who have brought their children, who have stood in long lines, uncomplainingly in most cases, to spend 2 or 3 seconds with Nelson Mandela. And the kind of range of emotion is intense because you see people in a very kind of a supportive and friendly atmosphere in the moments leading up to the point where they see his body. And then after this, just this intense emotion, the silence. The silence is quite profound because I think on a visceral level, when people register that this great man's spirit has departed the earth, it becomes very real just how much we have lost. And I think the kind of reactions that we're seeing from people in those moments after that realization is made are quite profound.
Karen Morn, journalist with E-News Channel Africa in Johannesburg. Now, India's Supreme Court upheld a law which bans homosexuality in a ruling that has outraged the country's gay community. According to the law dating back 153 years, same-sex relationships are considered an unnatural offence and carry a potential 10-year jail term. Earlier, I discussed the ruling with Mahima Kaul, journalist and fellow at the Observer Research Foundation in Delhi.
So the Supreme Court decision has come about 5 years after a High Court decision. We have something called Section 377 in the Indian Penal Code. And Section 377, basically, I can read it out for you. Section 377 of the Indian Penal Code reads, unnatural offences, whether voluntary, has carnal intercourse against the order of nature with any man, woman, or animal, shall be punished with imprisonment for life or with imprisonment of either description for a term which may extend to 10 years, which will also be liable to fine. So what basically Section 377 of the IPC says, that any sort of carnal intercourse which is against nature or unnatural can be punished by life imprisonment or any other imprisonment the court awards. This section extends to men who have intercourse with men, men and women, and either men or women with children. When it comes to unnatural offenses, in general, this is extended to the gay community. And they have been the ones who really borne the brunt of the law.
You've got this contradiction of India as a democratic country, one that I understand actually recognises transsexuals and eunuchs as people who can offer blessings. And then on the other hand, you have the issue of same-sex relationships, which the conservative factions in India are vehemently opposed to.
Well, let's put it this way. This Section 377 is, it's been there since the British times. It's a colonial law. it was there before the Constitution of India even came about. We haven't changed it. I mean, in the 60-plus years since independence, nobody has touched the section. And so what happened in 2009 was the High Court actually sort of put some layers and said that if there's consensual relationships, the police should not be allowed to come and book anyone under that. And only if it's non-consensual should some action be taken. This was challenged in the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has basically said that if a certain community is marginalized or attacked because of this section, it's not because of the law. It's because of the abuse by police officers. So by itself, Section 377 is constitutionally valid. And at the end of his judgment, it is said that if the parliament chooses to go ahead and remove this section, that's what the parliament should do, because it says that as the Supreme Court, it does not want to be guilty of sort of judicial overreach, and that's why it is not sort of deeming it unconstitutional. So on that count, yes, the court could have taken a more progressive line. It could have taken a decision more in line with what the High Court said, and it could have sort of kept its decision in line with sort of a modern India, you know, and how people in urban areas are, even in rural areas for that matter, been a bit more real about its judgment. But it didn't. It has in some ways passed the buck on to the parliament. And if the parliament is ready to take up this issue, we don't know as yet. On the other end of the spectrum, yes, of course, they do have a social function. But I think that it is one which, I think there's definitely a lot of marginalization of the gay community and the transgender community. And I think they make do with their lot. But I think that, from a sort of constitutional and a legal standpoint, we need to protect them much more than what we do right now, which frankly we don't.
Criminalizing homosexuality in India, a democratic country, will it actually have an impact, a social impact on the gay community there?
Well, India always works on two levels. So I think in urban India, there have been huge steps. You know, you have people in the entertainment industry, in the fashion industry, in, sort of more urban centers who are, they're out. They're not in the closet. You know, they have regular lives. They have gay nights. They have regular social lives, and it's quite acceptable. But then you have a more conservative India where children are scared to come out to their parents because parents are not accepted. You have, even till last week, there was a news item which said that there was an artist who put up an exhibition in a small town, in a big city in South India. And because he's gay, and because his art actually had nudes of, male nudes, some right-wingers came and they forced it to be shut down. And in the past, his paintings have been destroyed. So India always works on two levels. You've got a pocket of urban India, spread across the country, which has a fairly, fairly nice bubble for people who are affluent and can function in those bubbles. But then you have the rest of India, which is still yet to catch up. And I think that people face a lot of flack for their sexual orientation. And you would probably find that a lot of people are living a lie at this point because they're scared of what society would say or do to them.
Delhi-based journalist Mahima Kaul. Today, the House of Representatives took up the budget compromise struck by Republicans and Democrats this week after months of closed-door negotiations. While most lawmakers said it was necessary to pass the bill to prevent another government shutdown, many expressed strong opposition to the individual provisions in the more than $1 trillion legislation, such as the failure to end unemployment benefits and the exclusion of a measure to increase offshore drilling and fracking in the Gulf of Mexico. Other representatives blast party leaders for the way the deal was brought to the floor, limiting their ability to debate and make amendments in a rush to leave town for the holidays. On Capitol Hill, Alice Ulstein has more.
It could have been worse. That was the prevailing sentiment on Capitol Hill Thursday about the 2014-2015 budget deal reached by House Republican Paul Ryan and Senate Democrat Patty Murray earlier this week. Republicans continually emphasized that the bill does not raise taxes, while progressives like Vermont Independent Bernie Sanders expressed relief that the deal makes no cuts to Social Security or Medicare. But Sanders refused to say if he would support the bill as is.
There are a lot of issues in there which are not very pretty, but we're dealing with a very right-wing House. So I'm not sure how this whole thing is going to fold out. There are still issues out there that haven't been resolved.
Sanders and other lawmakers also criticized party leaders for setting up both chambers to vote on the massive bill without giving them the opportunity to propose amendments. Because the House of Representatives has insisted on leaving for vacation on Friday, the Senate will essentially be forced to approve whatever the House sends them.
And that's kind of like blackmail, and they're saying take it or leave it. I don't think we should be put in that position.
The bill that came to the House floor today was slightly different from the one unveiled earlier this week. In 11th-hour negotiations, lawmakers agreed to reduce the amount new federal workers have to contribute to their retirement pensions and approved a routine pay increase for doctors who treat elderly Medicare patients. But despite efforts by Democrats Thursday to include at least a three-month extension of unemployment benefits for the more than 1 million people set to lose them at the end of the month, House leaders did not allow a vote on the issue. House Speaker John Boehner said he would support extending unemployment insurance if it's paid for by cuts or raised revenue elsewhere. But Democratic Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi told reporters Thursday that the suggestions her caucus has made for paying for the extension, such as eliminating corporate tax loopholes and subsidies, have been met with resistance.
I mean, one little loophole someplace would take care of this just like that. But they have said it's off limits. We won't touch one hair on the head of the special interest in our country for initiatives that don't create jobs, that increase the deficit, and instead we're having to face narrower choices. But I don't even think it should be paid for, because you know why? It's an emergency.
In the past, Democrats and the president have gone to great lengths to preserve unemployment insurance by threatening to vote no or veto various must-pass bills. But while she called the situation intolerable, Pelosi admitted that this time around, they're avoiding that fight.
Yeah, we're unhappy. We're very unhappy about it. But not enough to say, therefore, we're going to make matters worse by not having an agreement.
Though Pelosi characterized the budget agreement as a draw rather than a win-win for both sides, New York Senator Chuck Schumer and other lawmakers are expressing cautious optimism that the deal could mean more cooperation between Democrats and Republicans in the future.
Now the specter of government shutdown will not be looming over our heads. And I particularly want to say that I hope this paves the way for agreements elsewhere.
But Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said he's not so sure, especially after Republicans used procedural tactics this week to delay a vote they could no longer block on the president's judicial nominees. These tactics kept the Senate in a marathon session Wednesday night, delaying a confirmation vote until 1 in the morning.
What they're doing the last few days is a picture of why we had to change the rules. Nothing but obstruction in big capital letters.
Congress members on all sides caution that it's not a given that the budget will make it to the president's desk, or that they'll find a path forward on the many issues facing them when they return in January, including raising the debt ceiling, appropriating money for all branches of government, and tackling immigration reform. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
This is FSN Reports. The U.S. military will begin this week to transport Burundi forces into the Central African Republic to help end the bloodshed gripping the war-torn country. According to U.S. military officials, the operation follows the death of two French soldiers killed in the conflict. Hundreds of people have now died in ethnic clashes, with thousands displaced. Earlier, I spoke to our Africa correspondent, Justin Natal.
This is the latest in South Africa, in Central Africa, is basically a climax of what started in March early this year when Seleka Rebels, which is an alliance of numerous militia groups in Central Africa, ganged up and overthrew the then sitting president François Bozizé. So you realize Seleka Rebel is a group is majority Muslim, and the Muslim population in Central Africa form like 15% of the country's population. So you have of late we've seen reprisal attacks from majority Christians burning mosques, carrying machetes, and basically killing people. Killing people in broad daylight with machetes and clubs. So you have up to 100,000 now displaced, close to 500 people killed from Thursday, and 2 days ago you had two French soldiers who also got killed in an exchange with Seleka in Bangui.
And you mentioned the French soldiers who were killed. France deployed some 1,600 soldiers to the CAR last week, over a week ago, and that's part of a UN-backed operation. Can you tell us what role the United States is playing in this conflict?
Yes, the United States has had presence in Central Africa, initially not directly dealing with internal politics or conflicts in Central Africa. The U.S. has had a special force that was working with the Ugandan army, trying to track down the elusive LRA, Ugandan rebel group that has been operating in that area. But the latest now is the U.S. is offering to provide logistics to AU force, which is also being deployed in Central Africa to basically stabilize that country, which has been in chaos. It dates back from the time of independence in 1960. So the U.S. will be airlifting Burundian forces who will be deployed in Central Africa as a part of the stabilization force to boost the numbers there. The U.N. is talking about 9,000 force that is required in Central Africa. You realize it's a very vast territory, so logistically, the African Union force face a lot of challenge because they don't have the finances. Two, they don't have the equipment that they need to move from one place to another. So the U.S. is going to chip in that direction.
Finally, you mentioned the displacement. We know of the ethnic rivalries that are driving this violence and bloodshed. Do people in the Central African Republic, do they think that this will eventually become a United Nations operation?
Central Africans are really not. This is a country that majority of the people are illiterate. All they want to see now is peace. That nobody is going to get a knock on their door by people who are carrying clubs or guns of different people, factions of different groups. You have the Seleka, you have the Christians who are going after Muslims. So the most critical thing for people in Central Africa right now is not who is managing the operation, but is the intervention going to bring peace in that country?
Africa correspondent Justin Natal. And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the programme by emailing us, reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Friday, the African women calling on the US government to lift its ban on abortion for victims of rape in conflict zones. That's Friday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks. For everyone, with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.